From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Hong Kong residents and Beijing at odds. Satellite's launch highlights India's cost-effective space program. Pakistan starts ground offensive in North Waziristan. These stories and more on this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. China's state-run Global Times warned Monday those behind Hong Kong's 10-day unofficial referendum on democratic reform threatened to divide the people of the special administrative region, adding that political confrontation does nobody any good and saying it will not bring about democracy, but will only shake the region's foundation for practicing democracy. Vote organizers say nearly 800,000 people cast ballots, mostly online, but also using a smartphone app or accessing a voting booth on several proposals that would allow the public to nominate candidates for chief executive, the territory's top leader, in a 2017 election. Beijing opposed the referendum that ended over the weekend and reminded Hong Kongers that their constitution or basic law stipulates all candidates for the leadership must be approved by a nominating committee. A Chinese government white paper or policy statement issued in mid-June underscored the unique one-country, two-systems arrangement, whereby Beijing permits a high degree of autonomy, but also emphasized that Beijing retains comprehensive jurisdiction over the territory and urged people to show patriotism to the country and warned that it will not allow chaos in Hong Kong. RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harrell told VOA's Victor Beatty the white paper may have played a part in awakening the concerns of Hong Kong residents over the future of democracy in the territory.
Beijing has been struggling to adapt to the political realities of a Hong Kong where the population is increasingly aware of political life, aware of the differences between the normative or ordinary life of Hong Kong political life versus political life inside the Chinese mainland, and China's finding that its approaches for dealing with Hong Kong, whether in terms of outright intimidation through the white paper or the appointment of pro-Beijing politicians or even what is widely suspected to be a campaign of covert manipulation through replacement of critical media voices with more pliable media voices and leveraging of triads to deliver messages to those who don't get in line are not succeeding in cowing the Hong Kong people. Instead, they've only incentivized them to stand up more to what by essentially revealing that the threat is real.
Does it matter that nearly 800,000 people cast ballots in this election?
It definitely matters. I mean, I think what it shows is that the population of Hong Kong is increasingly politically active and disposed to expect a role in their own governance. There is an expectation that 2017 will result in a real, genuine democratic election accountable to the people of Hong Kong and coming from them with candidates who are put forward by Hong Kongers, not by Beijing, and that this will be conducted according to international standards.
Do you think China will allow selection by the voters of the chief executive?
In the past, it seems to be the case that when Hong Kongers have shown a very strong, united position on an issue, Beijing has taken that on board and adjusted appropriately. Think back to the national security law discussion back in the mid-2000s. And it is certainly possible, since it's so clearly in Beijing's interest, not to have the worst-case outcome here of either turning Hong Kong fully against the mainland in some sense or of having to use force. China benefits from having a Hong Kong that is stable, economically prosperous, and at least in many important ways, happy or willing to accept Beijing's writ. If the relationship becomes highly contested, if Beijing appears too ham-fisted or ham-handed and approaches it with an intent to try to cow Hong Kongers or intimidate them repeatedly, that relationship will just become more costly and less effective from Beijing's perspective. So I think it is possible that Beijing will do this. It's simply up to them to now take this on board and adjust effectively.
Harold says he doubts China will resort to a violent Tiananmen Square-type crackdown, in part because pro-democracy activists who are part of the Occupy Central movement have so far shown skill in taking the moral high ground and avoiding antagonizing Beijing. He says both sides know their relationship is long-term and neither would gain from a confrontation. Pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong are also preparing to stage a huge rally later Tuesday to press the government in Beijing to accept their demands for genuine democratic reform. The rally has been an annual event since 2003 and is held on July 1st to coincide with the anniversary of Hong Kong's handover from Britain to China in 1997. Several factors could influence Tuesday's rally, including the Chinese government's recent white paper on Hong Kong's political powers and the democracy movement's successful staging of the 10-day referendum on electoral reform. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with longtime Hong Kong-based journalist Francis Moriarty and asked him how he thinks the rally will unfold.
Now, with all of this unhappiness over a range of issues, including democracy, coming together at the same time, I would anticipate that the annual protest march, which always takes place here on July 1st, will be a larger-than-usual turnout. How large? It's hard to say. I don't think it will be as large as the one that drove the first chief executive, Tung Chee Hwa, out of office in 2003. More than 500,000 people showed up in that march, and it sent a very clear message of unhappiness over the issue of so-called national security legislation. If the number in the march that's about to happen is anywhere near that number, I would say if it's anywhere north of 250,000, it would send a very strong message to the Chinese that they're going to have to find some way to widen the ambit of opportunity for the people here to express themselves democratically.
Those very big rallies, pro-democracy rallies in 2003 and then again in 2004, did contribute, it appears, to the decision of the first chief executive, Tung Chee Hwa, to resign.
It drove him out of office.
Right, as well as a few other ministers.
Yes.
Given the fact that we had a big turnout for the annual June 4th vigil, a big turnout in the votes on the referendum, and now potentially a very big turnout for the annual July 1st march, how big do the numbers have to be until more Hong Kong government officials quit?
Well, first of all, we have to draw a distinction between the June 4th event, which is marking the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, and the July 1st march. There may be any number of the same people involved, but they're very different events for very different purposes, and it's very difficult for anyone, even organizers, to draw a link in people's emotions and inspirations between those two events. So I think July 1st has to be compared with July 1st and not June 4th, especially as this June 4th was the 25th anniversary, which is a very special number. So it does suggest, however, that people may carry over some of their feelings to the July 1st event. I think that it's going to be a large event. If it turns out to be small, who knows? There's no way even organizers can know who'll turn up. It would give a confusing picture. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think the unhappiness level is high enough that will be a large crowd. There is the possibility that a lot of people who tried to vote electronically and found themselves getting blocked, people who struggled to go to polling stations that were sent up and had to wait for hours in order to drop their little ballot in a box, they may feel that they've already done what they needed to do, that they've sent their message, and that they don't need to go out again and walk in the street. So I think we're going to have to look at the 800,000 ballots and the number of people who choose to vote with their feet and view them a little bit independently and then perhaps add up the numbers. But we don't have right now the extremely strong feelings in the government that we had against the chief executive and certainly two key ministers in the era of Tung Chee Hwa. People here are unhappy with the whole government. They rate some people a little lower than others, but they don't have any individual target. It's the whole government.
Hong Kong journalist Francis Moriarty speaking with VOA's Michael Lippin. India took another step Monday in its ambitions to tap the commercial potential of its space program by launching satellites from four nations. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha has a report that Prime Minister Narendra Modi commended the country's space program as the world's most cost-effective.
3, 2, 1, 0, +1, +2.
India's polar satellite launch vehicle blasted off Monday morning from the eastern port of Sriharikota, carrying a 714-kilogram French Earth observation satellite and four smaller satellites. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who witnessed the launch, pointed out that all five satellites put into orbit were from advanced countries.
Even today's satellites are all from developed nations, France, Canada, Germany, and Singapore. Truly, this is a global endorsement of India's space capability.
The launch marks another milestone in India's efforts to grab a larger slice of the lucrative global satellite launch market. Focusing attention on the frugality of India's space program, Prime Minister Modi said India has the potential to become the world's satellite launch service provider. He pointed to reports that the $100 million spent on making the Hollywood movie Galaxy exceeded the cost of a spacecraft India sent to Mars last November.
Even today, our program stands out as the most cost-effective in the world. Our scientists have shown the world a new paradigm of frugal engineering and the power of imagination.
India's Mars program has won attention for its modest $73 million price tag. That is just over one-tenth of the money spent by NASA on a Mars mission it launched days after the Indian one. Indian scientists say frugality has always been the goal of a space mission whose annual outlay is just $1 billion, a fraction of space programs in major space-faring nations such as Russia and the United States. This is the advantage they hope to leverage in the commercial launch business. Mr. Modi also sought to leverage India's space program to give a further push to his diplomatic offensive in the South Asian region. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Pakistan's military says it has begun a ground offensive against terrorist hideouts in North Waziristan following 2 weeks of aerial bombing and evacuation of civilians from the region. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad, the northwestern tribal territory bordering Afghanistan, has long been a source of domestic and international terrorist activities.
After evacuation of all civilian population, the army says its troops and commandos have started a house-to-house search in and around Miranshah, the administrative center of North Waziristan. The army says the initial ground offensive has killed 15 terrorists and found tunnels and bomb-making factories. Islamabad began the counter-terrorism operation on June 15th by bombing suspected targets from the air. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif ordered the action after peace talks with the Pakistani Taliban collapsed because of repeated terrorist attacks. Former Pakistan Army spokesman, retired General Athar Abbas, explains the challenges of military action in North Waziristan.
In North Waziristan, it is treacherous, high mountains, caves, and small pockets of urban centers. So it will be more difficult as compared to the other areas. But then the army has operated in this area before also. And on and off, they have been carrying out targeted operations, small raids and ambushes, etc. But now the level or scale of operation is quite large.
North Waziristan is one of seven tribal districts along Pakistan's northwestern border with Afghanistan. While the military has conducted repeated counter-militancy operations in the other areas, it had not undertaken a full-scale offensive until now, despite pressure from the United States and other Western allies. Officials do not rule out the possibility of militant attacks elsewhere in Pakistan in reaction to the army operation. The military says it has killed nearly 400 militants since the offensive began 2 weeks ago and has confirmed the deaths of 17 soldiers. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Thai army officials are acknowledging how corruption among authorities and middlemen, as well as a lack of enforcing laws against human trafficking, have led the kingdom to be branded as one of the worst offenders for forced or exploited labor. As the country tries to clean up its image and keep workers valuable to its economy, VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Samut, Sakhon, where authorities are establishing one-stop centers for registering migrant workers.
Demonstrating the importance Thailand's military junta attaches to combating human trafficking, the Army's Chief of Staff, Sirachai Distakul, showed up on opening day at one of the new centers that document foreign laborers. About 2,000 people, mostly from Myanmar, gathered on the first day. They were photographed, fingerprinted, and x-rayed, and gave urine and blood samples. In exchange, they received a temporary labor identification card. If they pass the background and medical checks, they will be certified to continue working in Thailand. An estimated 200,000 Cambodians have fled Thailand since the May 22nd coup, fearing a crackdown on all foreign labor, legal or undocumented. The junta blames the panicked exodus on corrupt Thai officials spreading rumors so they could extract payoffs from the Cambodians when they eventually returned. General Sirachai calls it all a big cross-border misunderstanding.
We've allowed some of them to return because entrepreneurs will have trouble running their businesses if these workers are not here.
Construction worker Sampai was among the minority of Cambodians who did not flee.
I didn't want to return home. I knew it would be very difficult to return here if I did. I want to continue working here. My employer told me that I could stay in Thailand if I get this new card. That will allow my boss to prevent the police from taking me away if there is a raid.
The expectation is that this new system, in military fashion, will instill order and honesty. Immigration officials here tell us they're expecting to convert 90% of the undocumented foreign laborers in Thailand to legal status.
On the whole, if we follow the process, there will be no corruption. At the provincial level, we're adhering to the policy set by the National Council for Peace and Order. It's quite transparent.
Mint Ong, from Rakhine State in Myanmar, has been working on construction projects in Thailand for 2 years. He also has high hopes for the new system.
The old system was corrupt. We had to rely on brokers to get us identification cards, but the police would still shake us down for bribes when we showed the card. I heard the new ID card will be more helpful and secure.
Another incentive for utilizing the new system, an amnesty for undocumented workers who register, and no punishment for their employers who bring them to the one-stop centers. Steve Herman, VOA News, Samut Sakhon, Thailand.
It's just about 20 years since the World Conference on Women first convened, and it will again in Beijing in 2015. The Platform for Action was adopted by 189 countries in 1995, and it's considered a guide for gender equality and the empowerment of women worldwide. UN Women has launched a campaign to enlarge the conversation to include men and boys. Phumzile Mlambo Ngoke is the executive director of UN Women and the Undersecretary General of the United Nations. She explains to VOA's Francis Alonso that there's much to celebrate, especially the success of the legal strides made to empower women.
Many countries have passed legislation that outlaws gender-based discrimination. For instance, 139 countries now have constitutions that include guarantees on gender equality. 125 countries outlaw domestic violence, so women, in theory at least, have recourse. 117 countries outlaw sexual harassment at the workplace. And also, access to education for girls and boys has, in most countries, reached 50%. And then you've got the horrible maternal deaths that has in poor countries that we've seen it has been reduced by half. But the sad thing, though, is that still today, about 800 women die a day giving birth. So, you know, it's improved, but it's still bad. Same thing, we've got all this good legislation, but as you and I know, it does not mean because you've got constitution that guarantees gender equality, you've got a law that outlaws domestic violence, it means that it doesn't happen. So there's an implementation gap.
What lessons have we learned in the 20 years?
One of the lessons is the importance of involving men and boys. The second is the importance of involving communities as monitors of implementation.
How do you hold governments accountable for having everything in place but not necessarily implementing them?
Part of it is the electorate must vote the people that will do the right thing. That also means that you have to encourage as many women to be available for leadership. And we have seen in countries where you've had a critical mass on women in leadership, either as members of parliament, that the implementation of legislation is better and the passing of legislation that supports women is actually better. So we need to get the governments to embrace the importance of creating pressures for women to be in positions of power.
When you talk about influencing these leaders and people already in position of power, does the messenger matter?
Yes. The importance of involving men and boys, it's about changing the messenger. You also bring in the constituencies of people who think like you. Young people also has not been as engaged. So an intergenerational emphasis in terms of greater involvement. So the young messenger in their own right is an important new messenger to bring in.
Let's talk about Asia.
Yes.
How has it fared in this 20-year time frame?
It is a mixed bag. You have countries like Bangladesh, where they have done very well in addressing the issue of poverty. Asia has been able to outperform in reducing poverty, and that is due to women, the access to microcredit, and the opportunities for women to have a degree of economic empowerment. Or you go to Sri Lanka, where education reforms there have been so good, the performance of women in education has increased phenomenal. Then you've got the challenges of countries like India. Some parts of it, you've seen a lot of reduction of poverty, but you are seeing, as you know now, upsurge of violence against women. You've got women doing very well educationally. And then you've got countries like Afghanistan that has had a big focus on violence that is targeted to women so as to deny them their rights, women being targeted for going to school, women being targeted for being out of home.
How do we know that we're succeeding?
When we can say that the number of women that experience physical and sexual violence has decreased, and the number of women who report abuse, and the number of countries in which these crimes are prosecuted, when we actually have got action that is being taken and women have got recourse, we will know that we are succeeding. In terms of education, we've reached 50-50 in terms of girls and boys going to school, but the dropout amongst girls is still higher. So when the dropout of girls is lower and girls finish secondary school and they get into tertiary education, we will know that we are succeeding. When the majority of women in poor countries have access to health services and reproductive rights and reproductive services are accessible, we will know that we are succeeding.
Will it take another 20 years to see these successes?
A pronouncement has been made. It is in a draft form at this stage that by 2030, we must aim to have fully addressed gender inequality. In this campaign for Beijing, we are celebrating the progress that we've made, but much more important, we're calling for more action. We're calling for recommitment, and we're mobilizing men, women, young people, private sector to be part of the women's struggle.
Fumzile Mlambo Ngoka, Executive Director of UN Women and the Undersecretary General of the United Nations, speaking with VOA's Francis Alonzo. Stay right where you are. The latest world news is up next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese.